And I'd like now to welcome the directors of three amazing organizations. Sherry Taylor joins us from Esperanza Shelter for Battered Families. Maria Jose Rodriguez Cadiz joins us from the Solace Crisis Treatment Center. And Zuleika joins us from the Story Dancer Project. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And there will be a performance this weekend, Friday the 30th of November, called Harmonia 3. It's a performance to benefit all three organizations, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But let's talk about what all three of you do. Maria Jose, the Solace Crisis Treatment Center used to be called the Rape Crisis Center, and it has changed its name, and has it also changed what it does?
A little bit, and I wanted to say, first of all, thank you so much for having us three here, because I had the luxury of working with Zuleika and Sherry in a very intimate way, and this is a great opportunity for us to address the community so they know that we do not do what we do alone. Solace is your rape crisis center in town. We do hold a record of 39 years providing services for survivors of sexual violence and their families. But following best practices and following national accreditation standards, like many other rape crisis centers, we had to transform ourselves from 2005 to today drastically.
And why is that?
Well, the reason is because violence and trauma doesn't always look the same. And violence and trauma doesn't look the way 20 or 30 years, actually 40 years, when this center was created.
How is it different?
It is different because mostly when people come to us, they come now with a compound, with layers and layers of different sources of stressors. And it's the combination of all of them. And actually, a comprehensive approach to it, the real solution for stabilization, is no longer doing one thing that will put back their lives in order. So you had to be very comprehensive when you respond to them, and so forth. You cannot do it alone.
What are some of the different stressors?
For instance, well, we're going to hear about this probably from Sherry as well, what our economy is imposing on a lot of the people that live around of us has actually exacerbated their ability to cope. So whenever something happens on top of being fragile financially or, with your job, with your home, then it's another set of symptoms that are going to arise if, for instance, on top of that, you are experiencing violence. So basically, best practices have told us that when you help somebody that is being a victim of sexual assault, you actually are not doing things very differently than if you were helping somebody whose source of trauma is coming back from war or being a victim of any other violent crime or having been crossed by the losing a loved one suddenly or right. having a chronic illness that you didn't know you were suffering. That is what is making for agencies like us to change our mission and expand, because we can help all types of trauma, given that the symptoms more likely are going to be the same, and so the treatment is going to be very similar.
So Solace Crisis Treatment Center means that you are basically treating and seeing people who are victims and survivors of all kinds of traumas, not just rape.
Exactly. And we did have the luxury of starting doing so in 2005 because we were able to build this magnificent facility where we can co-house different service providers that are needed when we are responding to the people that come through our doors. So to give you an idea, we do have in our home, in our offices, the entire Crimes Against Children unit with the Santa Fe Police Department. Those detectives, men and women, are trained to respond to violent crimes against children and youth. And then we also have a representative with the state of New Mexico for the veterans. And we also have a program of St. Vincent's Hospital, which is called Sexual Assault Nurse Examiners. So when a person comes to us, them and their families don't have to tell more than immediately, more than once, what is affecting them. And then we can coordinate ourselves to provide the service without imposing them to go to 5 different facilities to obtain what they need.
And tell the same story over and over again, right. And get re-traumatized.
Right. Right. It's a lot more dignified. It's not so re-traumatizing. And listen, it is what's been done everywhere else in the world. We cannot do less in Santa Fe because we're going to be 40 years old. We need to know better. And we will never rest doing the same thing just because it might feel comfortable to us professionals. We must reflect constantly the ever-changing world of violence and trauma.
I mean, one of the things that you said that was really striking to me is that one of the problems that exacerbates trauma is the economic situation. And I was just having a conversation with a friend who said that not having enough money is the source of friction in all of our relationships when that's a problem. Even when there's no domestic violence or any kind of violence present, it just makes things worse to be arguing about or having to continually make decisions about money.
Well, what it does is it turns down or off your resiliency in general. So you're not that person that you were before. And your coping mechanisms start to maybe not be as healthy as they could be. You have to cope. We all have to. When we see people doing what some of us will judge as, you know, using substances the wrong way or isolating or whatever they do, you have to believe that most importantly and first of all, they are coping with something. And it's just a matter of helping them remember that there are healthy ways of coping. Which ones were those before they were affected by this trauma? They can go back to it. One of the principles that we, and I know Sherry and Zuleika believe on this as much as I do, today's days, the work that we do is based on resiliency. It is no longer based on the belief that when these things happen to you, you are damaged good forever. It is simply not true.
Right.
People are incredibly resilient. They just need to be reminded of how they did it before this thing crashed them temporarily. And that's what we're good at. Between 2 and 12 times, we can bring people back to a stability. And if they need any longer-term treatment or help, we know where to send them.
Now, how bad is... I mean, what kind of numbers and statistics do you have on rape and sexual assault in Santa Fe, for example? I mean, is it getting worse? Is it getting better?
You know, that's always hard to say because we don't know who we're not talking with. But I'll tell you what we know. We know that Santa Fe is no different than New Mexico. And in New Mexico, 66% of all the sexual violence that takes place is against children and youth.
Oh my
that is
goodness.
A chilling number that still makes me shiver. Every day of my 10 years doing this job, 66% are children and youth. And of them, 88% know very well or a lot the people that are inflicting this pain to them. That's the reality we live in. The rest are adults. And Sherry will tell you about this. The rest are adults who more likely as well know those who are hurting them. That's the reality of sexual assault from what we know. Now, something that is both chilling and very redeeming to me is that because of our expanded mission, because of our recent name change, which I know a lot of people may not understand completely yet, we are able to reach out and help those that could not come through our doors before. As it was important for 10, 20, and 30 years in our recent past to fight to have the name rape out, to say that it's not a dirty secret and that people need to be dignified when they're served because this has happened to them, is as important to also preserve their privacy and confidentiality when they're reaching out. Most importantly so if they're men. I don't mean to sound stereotypical, but men have a more difficult time still today's days to reach out. They were not coming through our doors. We changed the name. They're coming now.
Oh, that's so interesting. So they, when they are victims of sexual assault, were afraid to actually seek treatment until you changed the name from rape to solace.
Right. I was, as any staff member, helping at the front desk from time to time at Solace. in conversation with men that walked through who were sent there by their doctors, and they had told me, ma'am, I know I need to be here, I need help, but my doctor didn't tell me what the name at your door is. This is the last thing I need for somebody to see me walking in and guessing immediately why I'm in here.
Right.
So now, because of the name change, you go there, I go there, somebody goes there tomorrow, nobody can really say the reason why. That's very redeeming. And also to finish with that change name rationale, best practices tell us providers that your name is the very beginning of you being trauma-informed, which means that you know how to respond without providing any more trauma or any more re-victimization to the people you serve. And your name has to say where people are going, not where people are.
Right. Now let's turn to Sherry Taylor from Esperanza Shelter for Battered Families. I mean, you've got a lot of the same, well, some of the same people or some of the same problems as Maria Jose was just talking about.
Yes. We serve primarily victims of domestic violence. We also have a full offender program that's court-ordered for 52 weeks, 52 sessions.
What's that?
Anybody can come, and it's free. And it's really about gathering tools to move forward with your life after you've committed a crime.
Oh, so it's for perpetrators of crimes.
Yes. But if you're court-ordered, there's a fee to come. If you have had a situation in your life where you realize that you're out of control and you want to come just on your own without any mandates or any interference from law enforcement in your life, you're welcome to come. It's very, very helpful. I always say that if I'd have known all the things that we provide to clients, all the information, all the tools, when I was 16, my life would have been like so different.
Why is that?
It's about teaching about respect.
I mean, did something happen in your life?
Yeah. It was a busy one.
Yeah.
As a child.
Yeah.
And but I wouldn't have had to learn everything, it seems like, the hard way. I would have had the tools. I would have been able to move forward. I've had great people in my life, and so I've made it out. And hopefully we can kind of stand at a pinnacle of that as far as information support and just being there for people.
Now, Esperanza Shelter for Battered Families, there are a lot of people who come and they stay and they're getting away basically from a violent person, and safety is the kind of centerpiece of your mission.
Safety and confidentiality. Confidentiality is actually the biggest point there. About 40 years ago, about the same time that the Rape Crisis Center, SOLAS, evolved, we were coming into existence as well. We're really big partners. So the federal government did a study, and they realized that more women were dying from domestic violence than any other cause. Any other cause. Breast cancer, car accidents, anything. And they decided that it was a national health epidemic and that they needed to do something. So they started filtering small pots of money into nonprofits to see how they could help. And Esperanza had been around longer, even before our 501c3. But there was no funding, so there wasn't a need for a board, and there wasn't a need for all these things. So roughly 40 years ago, more women were dying from domestic violence than any other cause. Today, it is not the number one killer of women. So that's good. So, but what we realized is...
So it worked. I mean, the response that these centers have had have really...
They're very helpful.
Yeah.
But the confidentiality we determined as time went by and we learned what we were doing was that we couldn't disclose any information to anybody because perpetrators of domestic violence come from every walk of life, every nationality, every financial zone, everything.
Every profession. They might be in law enforcement
or
the justice system.
Doctors. They might be important people. It could be, it could be your mayors. It could be anybody out there. So if we disclose information to anybody, it could be the life of a person that we've promised to protect as much as possible. So we have a 50-bed shelter here in Santa Fe. People come with nothing, absolutely nothing. Through the support of the community, we're able to provide clothes and deodorant and laundry soap and all the essential needs. We have 18 different funding sources that support We have a full housing program for 2 years for people. It's a small one. Very, very effective, that one is. We also have our support center, and we did change the name of that when we moved into our new building as well. It used to be called the admin building. And I'm like, I can remote in. We don't need this new building for me. We need it for the people we serve. So we have a child therapist there that's available. We do crisis management there for survivors and for offenders. Certain days we do services for offenders, and certain we provide the services for survivors. We also do a lot of outreach, education, awareness. Another way that we work with SOLAS is we have our Coordinated Community Response Council, and there are about 800 members attached to that and about 300 businesses. And it is the Coordinated... Can you help me out, Maria Jose?
Coordinated Community Response Council. It was a platform created by our mayor, Mayor Koss. He understood quite well that domestic violence and sexual assault, more often than we like to admit, do come together. And so he decided to create that and put a person in charge, Carol Horwith.
Thank you, Maria Jose.
Yeah. And actually, I think Esperanza was... the agency that brought it up from
We were the initiating,
scratch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'd sent someone off for a training, and they came back, and they're like, oh, my gosh, we've got to do this. And so as a collaborative effort with the City of Santa Fe, SOLAS, and Esperanza Shelter, we have been able to facilitate this.
And actually, it will be important to say for us that another great partner is our hospital. St. Vincent's has been a great member, and because of the influence of their director and the VP, we have now even a position inside the hospital that didn't exist before.
And they also recently just funded a position for Esperanza for a mental health and substance abuse counselor.
And Zuleika, who's been sitting here quietly, is the director of the Story Dancer Project, and you also provide services, and sometimes to people who are providing services to other people.
Yeah.
What's it about?
We're an international artistic health resource organization. I wanted to put art together with health, and at the time I did it, people thought it was kind of way off. And now I think, listening to both of you, I think we can all understand that things have moved further into a more multifaceted universe where what we do is we bring wellness and resiliency work and rejuvenation into other organizations that we partner with. I created, as you know, a set of exercises called Take a Minute for Your Life that are core wellness, very simple, one-minute things that bring joy and life somehow into people's bodies and then minds and feelings, and it brings some vitality when you use the word resiliency and revitalization. This seems to happen, and I have done this all over the world with women and girls to start with, and then children and now families. And because I live in Santa Fe and I've worked in the public schools a lot, and we've brought facilitators into the schools and done this in dual language work with children, I always wanted to work in these communities where women are suffering from domestic violence and children and men. And so I met Maria Jose and I met Sherry, and I wanted to go inside the shelter, and I was told that it was a great place of confidentiality and safety, and so I had this idea that they both helped me develop, which is to train the counselors working in both of the centers in these core wellness, simple and joyful moments that they will then, after learning them and feeling good in themselves, which everyone's reporting to be doing, be able to use them with their clientele. That's the idea, so that this is like a seed that turns into a plant, that turns into a garden, you know.
And so not only are you helping the counselors to keep themselves healthy, but also to pass that on to the clients in these places.
Right, that's the idea. And so far, we're having a great response. And so we We're all learning with each other, and it's quite amazing because intrinsically we all know that we feel good when we're in our bodies. But you said earlier, we don't have time, and now we live on the internet, we live on a computer, we have so many things to do. We're all worried about money, we're worried about our safety. And yet when you actually take a little stretch, even if you stretch your hands up in the air and take a gentle breath, you go, oh yeah, okay. Well, this is how it is today. Well, okay, I guess it's like this for you too, isn't it? Oh, okay. And just that little moment brings a kind of vitality into your hopelessness. And I think that by the Story Dancer Project, I feel so privileged to be joining these terribly worthy organizations that help so many, that I call them the forgotten ones, the ones that nobody thinks about. You could be walking down the street and passing a person who has been traumatized and you don't know it. And so to be able to be of some service is a great thing.
Now, there's a performance this Friday night, Harmonia, and it's a benefit for all three of these organizations. Do you want to tell us about it? You're one of the performers.
Yeah. It just felt like a moment. We have three performers. Michael Fitzpatrick is an award-winning virtuoso cellist. And actually, he's a recipient of a humanitarian award that I am also a recipient of, and that's how I heard about him. He's played cello for the Dalai Lama many times, and it's quite wonderful. And Issa Malouf is a world percussionist who you might know from playing with Rahim Al-Hajj, Albuquerque, and all over the world. He's an amazing drummer, and I'm a story dancer, and I work with stories from around the world. So I thought if we brought our work together, and then we could serve three organizations, Salas Crisis Center and Esperanza Shelter for Battered Families and the Story Dancer Project, and our partnership, this would be a seed idea in the heart of our own community to begin to understand that these types of collaborations are, in fact, happening, and you need some awareness and to bring yourself and your children to the concert. There's a different price for children as adults, and we welcome you all. It's Friday night, November 30th at 7:30 p.m. at the Rail Yard Performance Center on Paseo de Peralta, opposite Site Santa Fe, and you can call Brown Paper Tickets. Brownpapertickets.com, Harmonia3, to
and
get
it's,
tickets.
And it's 800-838-3006. We've just got a few minutes left, but before we go, the Solace Crisis Treatment Center, I know when I first moved to Santa Fe, I was a volunteer for the Rape Crisis Center. Is there still a volunteer program?
Absolutely. And you know what? It's impossible to conceive an agency like ours or Esperanza's without the community being behind it. Really, it's the only reason why we exist. Our volunteers are more important than any staff member that, you know, any of us together. And so we do have volunteers. They're trained like the way I think you might have been.
Yeah, there was a whole training.
Yeah. And so what they are equipped to do now is on a 24/7 basis, we have a hotline number that they are the ones responding to, and they can help people both doing what we call containing, you know, at the moment of the call, if they're not breathing well, if they don't have a good, you know, situation going through that night, at whatever hour they're calling, that they can relax, and also resourcing, which means giving them information about what's available in our community. And then, of course, from hours 8 to 5, we can accompany them to either court or whatever they need to go. We remain in the life of those who have been violated through violent crimes from the very beginning of their reporting to the police to the conclusion and the sentencing of their criminal cases. So we stay in the life of people for a long time.
At Esperanza, we also appreciate and engage volunteers. We have a couple of volunteer trainings every year. Our board members are volunteers. Many of the staff have come from the volunteer pool. I came from the volunteer pool. It's a place to find your heart and a good place to move forward in your life. Thank you, Santa Fe, for all your volunteering.
Sherry Taylor is director of Esperanza Shelter for Battered Families. Maria Jose Rodriguez Cadiz is the director of Solace Crisis Treatment Center. And Zuleika of the Story Dancer Project. And once again, Harmonia 3 is a performance this Friday at the Rail Yard Performance Center in Santa Fe at 7:30. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm delighted now to welcome Michael Pettit. He's the author of the new book, Artists of New Mexico Traditions. And tonight at 6 o'clock, he will be talking about the book at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be on Radio Cafe.
So this is a book about the National Heritage Fellows of New Mexico. What is that all about?
The National Heritage Fellowship Program was started by the National Endowment for the Arts in 1982 to recognize lifetime achievement in folk and traditional art. They use those terms interchangeably. Mostly these days we talk about traditional artists. Since 1982, 15 New Mexicans have been honored by the National Endowment for the Arts. And while we're a small state, New Mexico is wildly represented with these National Heritage Fellowships.
Because we actually have some remaining traditions.
Exactly. and from varying cultures.
Yeah.
So in 1982, the first New Mexican to receive the National Heritage Fellowship was a woodcarver from Cordova named George Lopez. And then since that time, we've had periodic honorees, most recently in 2007, Irvin Trujillo, the wonderful weaver from Chimayo, received his fellowship. And all of these artists are not only recognized by the National Endowment, but many of them have received governor's awards, mayor's awards. They have work in the Smithsonian, in the Vatican, all over the world. So they're recognized widely. One of the other things about these artists, however, is that they also represent many other artists in New Mexico. The traditions that these honorees hold up are broadly and deeply ingrained in our state.
Let's talk about some of those traditions.
Okay. I mean,
we're talking about weaving, we're talking about Indian pottery, we're talking about music.
Right. There have been potters honored, Helen Cordero from Cochiti, and Margaret Tafoya from San Juan Pueblo. There have been Santeros, Saint Makers, Charlie Carrillo, Ramon Jose Lopez, and others, weavers, musicians, Roberto and Lorenzo Martinez from Albuquerque. Roberto started a group called Los Reyes de Albuquerque, and his son Lorenzo began playing with them at the age of 8 or something.
Right.
And they were honored together.
And that's one of the things I think that's important about these New Mexico traditions, traditional arts in general, is that a lot of times people learn them from their parents and in the family.
Exactly. It is the most common way for these artists to begin their work. Occasionally, people are self-taught. There was no Santero, for example, in Charlie Carrillo's family, and he taught himself the art and also helped revive the traditional methods, which had fallen by the wayside. Other artists, we've had tinsmiths, culture embroiderers. It's just storytellers. Esther Martinez, Blue Water from Okeawinge Pueblo, was honored as a storyteller, but also as the person responsible for documenting the Tewa language. She wrote the first Tewa English dictionary and probably helped save Tewa from marginalization, if not extinction.
Amazing.
Incredibly amazing. And one of the things about all these artists, despite the acclaim that they've had, they all remain incredibly humble, and they are most enriched by the creation of their art.
I have to say, that sense of a kind of humble belonging to a much greater fabric You don't have any of that, oh, I'm a great artist ego coming through in this book. And it made me feel, I mean, I'm a relative newcomer having lived here only 20 years, well, but it made me feel proud to be New Mexican.
Well, I think our state is blessed with all these traditions. And, for example, one artist, Irvin Trujillo, the weaver from Chimayo, he's a seventh-generation weaver.
Right.
And when you have that kind of background, that kind of grounding for your work, it does help you feel modest. And as Irvin says, I didn't come out of thin air. I inherited these artistic traditions. That helps these artists remain humble and faithful to their work.
Yeah, very much so. I think it's important. I mean, the word folk art is something that has ever kind of changing and to some extent diminishing meanings as we become one world with so many interconnections. It's not like there's any subcultures of people who are naive and unconnected to the wider culture around them. And I think one of the things that's interesting that also comes out in your book is that one thing that really persists is not necessarily the subject matter, because that changes, but the materials and the techniques.
Right. And that's been a real... There are many storylines in this book, in part because there are 15 artists, but in part because they're different arts. But how does a traditional art survive in a contemporary world? All of these artists are... They're not creating copies of past work. They're putting their own individual artistic stamp on the work that they do, but it is grounded in the traditions. We don't tend to use folk art as a term so much these days, in part because there was an assumption that it was almost not art. It was more like a craft.
And utilitarian.
Yes.
As if utilitarian and art were somehow separate things.
Exactly. The Pueblo potters have been creating utilitarian objects, but they make them beautiful.
Yeah.
It is simply part of their culture. So the term folk art can carry with it the suggestion of less mastery than, quote, fine art. But in all of these artists' work, you see profound mastery.
Now, if an art form needs to be preserved, and there's quite a lot about cultural preservation, it means that it is in danger of not surviving. It is threatened. What are the threats to these traditional arts?
Well, some of that has to do with New Mexico's long history. The original artists, of course, were ancestral Puebloans in this part of the world. And then the Spanish came in 1598. With their traditions, and they met with the native traditions, and a uniquely New Mexican forms developed. Then what happened, these arts were originally threatened, actually, after New Mexico became first a territory and then eventually a state. What happened was the arrival of the railroad was a huge factor. The people in New Mexico could get inexpensive pots are inexpensive cloth, and some of the handcrafted arts begin then to languish. So modernization of the state led to the decline of many of these arts.
And there's a sort of weird irony, because it led to the decline of many of those arts because suddenly all this cheap stuff from elsewhere manufactured, we're the same thing now,
right.
Mass-produced stuff comes in. At the same time, the railroad brought people who then became a market for traditional arts.
Exactly. Yeah, the railroad not only brought in commercial materials rather than handcrafted material art, but it opened new audiences. And people from the East came in, and they were justifiably impressed by the native and the Hispano art that was here. And some of those same people were very much in the forefront of making sure that these arts did not disappear.
I was sort of imagining myself being an artist or craftsperson who was making these beautiful things and seeing the transition from a blanket being something that you make to use to cover yourself to something that you make to sell to somebody back east or whatever, and you're never going to see it again, and it becomes about a market, and it becomes collectors. And I mean, that's the way the world has gone, but there's a kind of poignancy and sadness to that in a way.
There is. All of these artists, as modern individuals who have to make a living, and by the way, most of the artists always had paying jobs. They didn't exist solely on their art. Lots of them worked up at Los Alamos, or worked on the railroad, or worked in different modern industries, and created their art when they could. But these artists are not in a bubble. They are aware of the changing world. They're aware of market forces. They're aware of what they need to do to get their work out there to the public. I think there's certainly not any of these artists who abandoned artistic integrity for the marketplace. They didn't start making junk.
Right.
But they're keenly aware of wanting to remain current. For example, this is why the Spanish Colonial Art Society at Spanish Market recently introduced innovation within tradition as a category. It used to be simply traditional art, and you couldn't have the wrong sorts of images. Nowadays, they understand that the public and collectors are interested in a variety of expressions, and these artists are eager to do that. Charlie Carrillo maybe has created who knows how many San Isidro retablos, and at a certain point, as an artist, he wants to do something a little different. So that's certainly a factor, and I think most of the artists are happy to have individual collectors buy their work.
Yeah, very much so. It's just it's a different way of life, and this way of life that we have now that's got lots of manufactured stuff has a lot going for it.
Right.
I mean, very few of us want to go back to the land and have to make our own every single thing that we use. But at the same time, it has the danger of affecting the way you see what you're doing and see the culture that it came from.
Right. Yeah, there are certain things, there are certain elements that the artists refuse. For example, I interviewed for the book Nancy Youngblood, who's a contemporary Santa Clara potter here in Santa Fe. And she's the daughter of Margaret Tafoya, one of the National Heritage Fellows. And her grandmother, when Nancy was first learning pottery at her grandmother's knee, her grandmother was adamant that you don't buy commercial clay. You don't fire in a kiln. You don't. There are many, many things that you need to do to preserve the tradition. You have to do it in the old way.
And who knows, eventually we may need all those skills.
Well, truly. And we certainly need the aesthetic and spiritual rewards that handcrafted art gives us.
Exactly.
It's an enormous gift to us, that beauty.
We're talking to Michael Pettit about his book, Artists of New Mexico Traditions. Now, one thing that was also interesting in terms of nobody's in a bubble, there's a lot of connections among all the different cultures here in New Mexico, especially the Spanish and Indian traditions.
That's exactly right. All of the National Heritage Fellows from New Mexico are either Native or Hispano. We haven't yet had an Anglo recipient. That's because there were such long, deep artistic traditions in these cultures. The other thing that has happened over New Mexico history is that there's been great intermarriage among Indian and Hispano people. It is very rare to find one of these artists who does not have some mixed blood. That's a term in New Mexico we use as mestizo, mixing. And it's not only in terms of your blood heritage, but it's also part of your artistic heritage. And they have lived side by side for 400 years, and it's no wonder that there is influences back and forth. And that's a beautiful thing. Absolutely.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and it's published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. What are your hopes for this book?
Well, my true hope for this book is that it brings the work of these artists and the other artists who work in the similar traditions, brings it to an even wider audience. I mean, we have Spanish market, we have Indian market, people know about artists, but this was an opportunity with this particular book to cross boundaries. It's not just about Spanish colonial art. It's not just about Pueblo art. It's not just about people from working in a certain art form. It's representative of the heritage of New Mexico as a real melting pot. We were a melting pot before Ellis Island was ever around.
That's right.
Or before the Pilgrims came. You know, there were already these cultures interacting with one another. And so I think for people to realize the depth and breadth of that story is what I'd like. And these people have become friends.
Well, how did you come to write this book and to get to know everybody? And
the book was actually stimulated by a 2009 exhibition at the Museum of International Folk Art. Nicolás Chávez was a curator for an exhibition of the work of all of New Mexico's National Heritage Fellows. And I went into that opening and was talking with Ramon José López, who works in multiple forms and is a master of all of them. And I was just stunned. And I said, Ramon, has anybody done a book about you? And he said, well, no. And I said, somebody should. And later on that evening, I was speaking with Tom Augustin, the then director of the executive director of the Museum of New Mexico Foundation. And I said, you know, nobody's written a book about Ramon. Someone should. And Tom sort of kind of looked at me and pointed at me. And that was the genesis of the idea to do the book. And it was quickly clear that it would be all of the National Heritage Fellows, and also quickly clear to me that I could not approach all traditional art in New Mexico because there is so much of it. So the National Heritage Fellowships were the opportunity to write about select artists who nevertheless represented many traditions and many other artists, past and present. And when I was setting up, I did interviews with all the living artists. There are only 5 of the 15 who are still alive, unfortunately. But I did all the, I interviewed all of the living artists and the families of the other artists, museum directors, gallery owners, collectors, to try to get a broad context for these individuals. When I was doing this, arranging for these interviews, I realized I had to have a record of it. And because we'd lost 10 of the 15, I said, I want the best, this is a unique opportunity, I want the best record I can have. I was going to videotape it. Initially, I was going to do audio tapes, but videotape, we have the technology.
And there's so much beautiful visual art in this.
Absolutely. It was great, great opportunity. So once I said, I'm going to videotape these, then all of a sudden, I was not only writing a book, but I was producing a documentary video, which will premiere at this year's Santa Fe Film Festival.
That's coming right up.
Yeah, it premieres on December 8th.
What's it called?
It's called Living Traditions, Folk Art of New Mexico. And we were very pleased that it was selected for the film festival. But it's another way to get this story out there. So all of a sudden, I was lucky enough to speak with you when my last book came out, and nothing had really lit me up since Writing for the Brand came out. And I didn't want to do anything that I didn't really want to do. And once I saw this and started on this, I knew I had found my muse, I guess it is.
And the rest is history, namely this book. It's called Artists of New Mexico Traditions, the National Heritage Fellows, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. Michael Pettit is the author, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock, and you'll be signing books.
I will, and let me mention something else. Dorothy Massey at Collected Works and Mary Massey Wolf also agreed to hang a show of these artists' work, and that will be up tonight through the end of the year at Collected Works. There'll be, for example, a buffalo hide painting by Ramon Jose Lopez. There'll be retablos. There'll be weavings, jewelry, straw applique work. And many of these artists will be joining me on the program tonight. They'll also be signing books, signing their respective chapters, and speaking a little bit to the audience about their traditions. And to have this, we'll probably be 10 people, to have these 10 extremely talented people there is exactly what the book is about. I'm trying to get this work to as wide an audience as possible.
Well, it's a very special evening tonight, and we look forward to seeing you there.
I hope you'll come to Collected Works at 6 o'clock.
Michael Pettit, thanks for being on the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Enjoyed it.